put stuff, you write stuff in his message like that. You may make two or three sentences about it.
But you mean the first he may know about the bill is when he hears it being debated in the legislation?
Sometimes that happens.
That doesn't bother?
Mm-hmm. No, because again, he's going to tell you that if you don't have any confidence in you, he's going to get rid of you.
Isn't that putting an extraordinary amount of confidence in staff?
Mm-hmm.
Don't they screw up?
Mm-hmm. Because he can tell, he has his own bills. You know, we have group bills. Is that what you're talking about, just the group bills or his bills? Yeah, we have those. But the, which all of us just fight for, that's what you're talking about. You know, like basic bills, like his basic bill might be an environmental bill or ethics bill or financial disclosure bill.
How many people are already on the staff who have the authority to have legislation introduced coming out of the governor's office?
Right now, so I'm about the only one that does that. See, most of the others make sure that, see, most of them work much more closer with the governor because they're considered to be aides and I'm not. See,
that's what I asked you about senior staff.
Yeah.
You said there was just one.
Yes, I'm a coordinator. See, well, we don't define that way. Just by title, there's a difference in title much more so than anything else. See, they are aides. It's called executive aides to the governor, and I'm the coordinator, which means tonight. That's why I indicated to you earlier.
Your education coordinator.
Yeah.
Are there any other coordinators?
No, I'm the only one. That's what.
Is there a table of organization in this office?
Within the office itself. Yeah, in a sense that here again, governor, the executive staff member, which is Jim Apthorpe, and the rest of the staff members, you know, they're classified as aides and an advisor. I'm a coordinator and an advisor, and which means we're basically on the same level. We have different titles and different. It's a responsibility level, the responsibility load more so than a hierarchy.
I've organized. The governor's office about four different ways, but they don't have any line responsibilities. You're the only one that. Do some of the other aides have responsibilities with the other cabinet departments?
Yes, they do. See, every one of them has a responsibility with another cabinet member. Okay, mm-hmm. But we do have a few who are aides that don't, like the appointment secretary, for instance, the press secretary.
Apthorpe is basically chief of staff.
Right, and he's the chief of staff. So we come down, governor, chief of staff, you know, and the rest of us, which we collectively call staff members, okay? Now they're called aides and advisors, and here when you get to the last spot where I am, it's called advisor and coordinator. You know, it's still just a block on the same plane, on the same staff level. But because of my respect, I'm the only doctorate on the staff, PhD on the staff. I'm the only black on the staff. I'm the one that has a large budgetary area. I have a few more freedoms than the rest of them do, which is much more of a governor's decision than an actual line kind of description.
Did that emerge when were you told that was the case?
Well, no. I think it started. I think it's much more of a combination of both of them. When the governor first told us that, he gives you a lot of freedom and latitude to do some of the things you want to do. But in addition to that, you sort of develop your own feel for things. And probably when you get to know him, you pretty much understand the way he is, the kind of guy whose whole thing is being honest and being straightforward and being truthful for people, not misdoing, not taking a penny from anything. And the staff he chooses will just about run the same route.
See, really, one of his problems is that because he's so honest and straightforward, he doesn't perceive the evil in anybody else, and therefore, when he makes an appointment and something goes wrong, it's difficult to reconcile it.
Yeah, see, that's why I said, luckily, he's been very blessed.
With his appointments?
Yeah, that's what I indicated to you earlier, that he's been he's been pretty much blessed, and you asked me earlier, you know, why, I said at that time, I don't know what his providence is. He had three or four angels in his pocket.
What has he fired any staff people?
No.
Do you think he would just fire somebody outright if he thought they were violating?
Most definitely.
How did you rationalize Tom Adams?
is just the kind of person that doesn't play his kind of, he doesn't play a kind of politics. But that's not the way he, that's not his living. That's not the way he lives. That's not the way he deals with people. Tom Adams said the governor cut him off after he got elected. That's not necessarily true. The governor just didn't want to play that kind of politics. And secondly, Adams spent most of his time taking cruises and farming and running back and forth to Latin America. But the governor just doesn't do that. And see, Adams will play much more of this business about patronage, paying off your buddies and giving stuff under the table. Rubin ain't going to do that. And you just think, it was a few times, well, look, you're the governor, so you'll tell you right when it's fine, I don't have to be. And then they call his mother, everybody else call him, the Rubens, I tell you, but if you put a black on a Volusia County school board, you'll never be reelected. He said, well, good. You know, they let them elect who they want to elect. They said, Rubin, you tell me, I'll tell you one thing. If you don't approve the Environmental Act to make it possible for some of us to buy lands over here and make a fortune, making a killer on all the panhandles, you're going to lose all kind of political friends in the state. He said, fine, I'll lose them. I wasn't born governor. He said, if you don't start campaigning early, you know, Tom Adams is going to kill you. He said, when is the election? He said, in July. He said, good, I'll start in July. In the meantime, I'm going to try to run a good, clean, decent administration.
That may sound just a little too good to be true.
Yeah, he does, but he gets by. And he does. But he gets by, though. I say I've always wanted him to be a little dirty and get some people about things they try to do to him. He doesn't do that.
So where's he going?
He always said, Claude, I think I can catch more flies with sugar than I can with vinegar. I'll get them. He said, I'll come. They get a little ahead of you, but you get them. He says, I got more faith in the people. And he gets this many Lincoln for life. I don't think you can fool all the people all the time. So no later they'll catch up with you. Right now, every cabinet member in the state is under investigation with him. See what they're saying now? He wouldn't turn the other in. See, everybody else on the block is stealing, so, and if you're not getting caught, then you must be turning everybody else in. You see, and that's good thinking. See, all of a sudden, what you're saying is that, you know, the fact that we're stealing is not the issue. The fact is that somebody's reporting those crimes, and that's what we need to be persecuting, that guy who's reporting them. And that's what you call a good Southern politician that can do that. Who can tell you, look now, let's not be concerned about who's stealing, let's be concerned about who's reporting. See, first of all, Rubin wouldn't even stoop that low to even think about reporting. And secondly, I just sort of insulted that he would do it. And to say that it's not even important that you're stealing.
Aren't you saying that the voters in the state are a long ways ahead of the politicians?
I think they are, to some degree. I hope they are. And I'm not gonna say that. I don't know. You know, I got a very strong belief, though, that voters are really rather masochistic. I think they love for people to do them in. The Adams and the Nixon, they'll keep getting reelected.
Could Rubin ask who gets elected governor of Michigan?
I would probably say no.
Why?
Because he's not slick enough. Rubin ain't going to play the slick politics. He can make out well in Florida. Because down here the people say, as I told you before, they want you to hang out that shingle, which is an important factor. They'll say, I tell you what, says Rubin, I've heard him say this. He said, I tell you what, now he's a good old boy, you know. Now I disagree with the way he's giving all those blacks a decent job and letting them go to schools and unlock that stuff like that, and the way he's sort of, you know, saying that everybody should have a decent opportunity to live in society. Now, he's wrong about that, but since he's a nice guy, I'm going to forgive him. And I can't even explain it, you know, but the farmers, right, they understand that.
Are you saying they like him because, in effect, they disagree with his progressive programs and his, quote, liberal attitude, but they say that they like him because he'll stand up even when he's wrong?
That's right.
For what he believes in,
that's
even when
right.
he's wrong?
That's right. You said it better than I did.
I went to a textile worker to explain to me why he supported Strom Thurmond.
I heard that for 5 years, and I worked for George Romney. Same thing. We don't like his standing income tax, but by God, he's honest.
See, somehow people vote for you on that. I don't know why, but they do. But see, to me, that would frighten me.
Because it's atypical. Huh? Maybe because it's atypical or perceived as atypical.
I think that's what it is, because see, most of these guys around here, I put down around here to lie to you, and as the guy said recently up here, you urinate in your ear until you're soft rain, a warm rain. And that's what, and I've heard all the lines around here. I've heard lies, there's something, but Ruben ain't gonna ever tell you that.
So why do you stay?
Huh?
Why do you stay?
Just because of him. He's a rather unique person. And of all of them I've met all over the country, Ruben is totally different from all of them. And I can't quite explain why.
Is he motivated primarily by religious attitudes?
I think so.
Do you find that frightening in any way?
No, but I think it frightens other people. It frightens a lot of his adversaries. It increases their hatred for him.
Why?
Because it reflects back on him. It mirrors what they're doing. It gives him a sort of hangs a crucifixion in front of their face. Who wants to be working around all the time? Every time you look around, the shadow of the cross is in your eye, and you're busy trying to stuff your pockets. Would you enjoy that?
I'm asking you.
No,
this time I'm the interviewee.
I'm just saying. That's my own personal feelings. You know, he supports.
Well, is he that different from everybody else before and everybody else around him in the cabinet and so on?
Yes.
That different.
He's that different.
I'm asking this question playing devil's advocate, but is there potential for fanaticism there?
No.
Why?
No, because he never asked anyone else to accept his beliefs and his philosophies. He never imposed them on you.
But if you wanted to play traditional politics, if you wanted to play, you know, traditional pork chop politics out of this office, you suggested that you wouldn't last very long if you found out about it.
So in a sense, he does impose that on
you. No, I mean, in that regard, yes. In the regard that he has a commitment to the people to make sure he runs a good administration. But that's above and beyond his own personal philosophy about things. But what it is, Reuben tends to cut a fine line between that which he believes in and that which he practices. And the blend comes out to be the kind of a blend that somehow tends to make him acceptable to, for instance, the people in the country, like as he won the Country and Western Award last year for politician, beating Wallace and Nixon out.
He won the Country and Western Award?
Mm-hmm.
Who is that given by?
I don't know, the group that came down here from out of Tennessee, the Country and Western Award.
From Nashville.
But what I'm saying is that, you know, what do you have to do to beat Wallace and Nixon? At the same time, he won the National Profile and Courage Award from the Baha'i Brit, I believe. That big long thing they give out for profile and courage. He won that too. Now, how do you put those two together? At the same time, he was elected to the Education Commission of the States. Again, by individuals who said, you know, he has that kind of an image that Reuben takes care of business very directly. He's an extremely sharp guy, smart guy. He has stature and he has poise. He gives you a feeling that Reuben is not a politician. He always makes you feel like he's a statesman. And that's the feeling I always have when I'm with him. He's always very, very natty in his dress, and he's a friendly guy, and he's very sharp and very bright. And he's a fun guy. But you know, but he's the kind of guy that'll give you a share. If he's got two fingers, he'll give you one of them.
Does he have a sense of humor?
Yes, extremely so. Loves a joke and play around with you.
Where do you think he's going?
I don't know. That depends on the moral standards of this country.
Well, let's assume he's reelected. There's nothing to be anything in the way. Now what? He's one of only two Southern governors to be reelected, because most of them, of course, can only serve one term. The other one's Edwards. Now where is he nationally?
Oh, you got Kennedy up here. I mean, not Kennedy, but Wallace.
Keep forgetting George Wallace. Well, other than George Wallace, When the staff sits around,
I
know the staff doesn't drink and not ask you stuff, but when they sit around talking about senior, what's going to happen in 1976? What are they in there?
Well, that was based on whether or not the Democratic Party would again would find a necessity to pick a governor over a senator, which I'm probably inclined to believe they would.
Or go south.
That's what I'm saying, for two reasons. First of all, I think that the Watergate taint's going to be so strong by 76 that they're going to want to get somebody who's not associated with Washington. And secondly, they'll probably feel that, that we're going to do like the Republicans try to do. We're going to go big business-wise, which means pick somebody who's had the experience in running a business or running a state. Let's go for a governor. To go for a governor, they only got two in the country that has visibility, and that's Wallace and Rubin. And so they tried to get Rubin for the vice presidency for a long time, even before it became public knowledge, to run with McGovern, and he continuously refused it. Prior to that, they'd already drafted him to be the keynote speaker for the Democratic Party. Again, you raised this question about whether or not he'd be a fanatic earlier. You see, one of their whole thing was that in talking with them, why did you want Rubin to be your keynote speaker? Is it because it's the custom to have that individual who has the kind of image and the flavor and the understanding, that we've, for humans and for the direction of the park. And Rubin was the one. That's why they asked him to give the keynote address, which you probably didn't even hear.
I heard it.
I did.
1972 was the...
And that's what they were at. They're fine. That's what we want. That's why we want him to get a keynote address. And again, he has a... let me go back and try to explain, then we'll come back to this other question. Rubin has the luck and a sense of being honest and being truthful and being for real and down to earth with people that Nixon has in being conniving and hooding.
Well, that would make him extremely skillful at it. If you're going to turn it around.
Now, that's the best way I can explain it. Episode after episode that I've been in here, telling me it comes sometimes four or five a day, or maybe a big three or four big ones a week. And Rubin, you asked me earlier, how does he survive? And you asked me that, one of you asked me that? That's somehow he flips the hit on his feet and take those positions. And God knows, I don't know how he does it. You see, I'm just going to be, we have to be honest, be truthful, and he hits on his feet. And I know that's why I pointed those signs early and told you about that. And I don't know how he does it, but he does it. He has the skill and the personality when he talks to people and sit down and talk on TV that they buy. Rubin will sell them tanks to save gas. He's just a little old country boy, and he's telling me, that sounds good to me. Let's get some tanks and save some gas. But nationally, though, going back to the other question, nationally, I think that it would probably switch down between Rubin and Wallace. If I know the Wallace people, it would be a... You say, where would Rubin go? Unless Rubin's luck changes drastically, or unless the morals of this country take a drastic twist for the better, Wallace people turn around and try to do us in.
Well, would he take second spot on the ticket in 76? With someone other than McGovern, right?
I don't know. He's always discouraged. He always said he wasn't interested. He's been saying it.
We're not talking about after he's been reelected. We're not talking about a situation where he's been reelected. It's 1976.
I don't know. Then he might then, because up to before he's always said no, he wasn't interested.
You move down here from the north. You go to the National Governors Conference. Mm-hmm. You go to the Southern Governors Conference. You see any difference in Southern politics and Northern politics? Here's what I'm asking. Is there any point in writing a book about Southern politics? Does it differ from what you know in other parts of the country?
I think so.
Oh.
Here again, I'm not... I'm not quite sure whether I can articulate it, the difference, and then secondly, I'm not sure whether I've accurately been able to determine it, that there is a difference. But for instance, I can go. You go into small towns. Like maybe this might even be true in the north. So you have, here again, you have to respond to that. You go into small towns around here, and then it's sort of traditional. I can go and I can find, for instance, one guy running the whole town. Now maybe that's also true in the north. This guy runs everything there, and he owns everything there, including the sheriff and the commissions and everybody else. But the difference between the north and south, what I gather, is that everybody knows it and it doesn't make any difference in the south. In the north, that's not true. North, when I had my little contacts with the police department there, and we used to on the 7th floor, and we used to deal with the mafia. Mafia had monies, clean money, supposedly good money, run into larger big boys as a front, blue ribbon cleaners, Shell gas station, you know, a few other operations like that, you know, before, under one guy. But that was the information you had to dig for. And the guy would always try to keep it. But here they don't do that. That's where the pork and chopping term comes from. Here they just take care of each other. They do it outside.
You saying that the South is more open than the North?
Yeah. And again, when you ask me about why they accept stuff, they're inclined to accept, let you do something if you do it. And you go into areas around here and they just do it. Do it outright. For instance, I don't think, for instance, that let's take another issue. Let's take one of the civil rights issues. When back 10 years ago, when the various blacks and whites who were in civil rights were being killed, you know, beaten to death or blown up or shot. See, all that was done with people's knowledge. People knew what was going on. They didn't even have to do it under the cover of darkness. Sheriff McCall. Reuben made the papers last year, made, I think, Life magazine, this fight with Sheriff McCall. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Two-Gun McCall, huh? Do you remember that? As a matter of fact, I think the book, Cool Hand Luke, was sort of been inspired by this guy, written out about him. He's a guy that had been sheriff for 25 years. He'd always bragged about how many blacks he'd killed. So, about last year, a year or so ago, He stomped a black to death for having an expired window sticker on his car.
This is where?
Down in Lakeland, Florida. You know, pull a black over having an expired window sticker. We have to find a window sticker every year on your windshield. And one day after the expired, they haul you and give you a ticket. And this black windshield sticker expired, I think it's something like February or March. They took him in and shot McCall, the sheriff, stomped him to death, killed him. As the Reuben said, you'd never do that in my state and get away with it. These guys, well, McCall's been here 25 years. He's a legend in his own time. He bragged about how many blacks he's killed before, man. Reuben, that'll be the last one. And they had this big fight for about a year. And everybody was upset, telling Reuben to leave him alone because he'd never get reelected. How what a big, powerful man he was. That was a big thing. Reuben pulled everything in the book to find him, broke him and busted him. It took about a year to do it, though. Everybody said that Reuben would never be reelected for that in Florida. But that had really hurt him. He had bothered a hero, a Southern hero. They said when he went for a corporate tax rather than put a state tax on the people, all the big bankers, all the big money people in the state of Florida said Reuben would never be reelected. He put a corporate tax on the people and messed, you know, upset the apple cart and on down the line. And he went for busing. He messed with all these sacred things. He's grabbed all the sacred issues that nobody else would touch. Judicial reform, busing, environmental reform, the disclosure laws, ethic bills, you name anything you want. And like I said earlier about Nixon, he hits on his feet every time on it. And don't ask me why, but he does. After you asked me a question, I got off on that. I don't know what I was asking.
What the difference between North and South.
Oh, North and South, yeah.
So distinctive regional differences.
I think the distinctive difference is really that is the way they conduct politics. Let me try to, and I can't quite pinpoint the difference for you, and I'm sorry I can't. For instance, Maddox can get up and conduct a legislative session. Maddox knows about as much about parliamentary procedures as you know about flying or your pilot. That's it, so I got it. As a pilot too, I shouldn't just use that example. But I know Maddox can't fly it, let's see. And instead of using Robert Rules of Order, what he was going to use, see, Maddox said, I'll tell you one thing right now, I'll just double dog that if you say that there again, just shut up at the board there talk. And no, it doesn't bother anybody, you know. Any of the rules can be broken. But he does it in such an honest way, you know, an honest, ignorant way in this sense. He gets away with it. And the same thing in business ventures. They can do it and do it, you know, and say, look, now, no, you're not going to be honest. You just give me what you're going to give me, and I'm going to give you what you're going to give me, and give out all this stuff, let's go buy a bit. And they get away with it, and that's where the politics conduct. They'll do it and just, they call it pork chopping, looking out for your buddy. But the North is a much more skillful and polished. They'll do you in too, but they get a, and that's really what I'm saying, if you're going to write, that's the thing I think you have to watch for. And I'm not sure right now, I'm trying to grab for a term that would express what I'm, or convey what I'm trying to tell you in this different, the debarkation here, and I can't figure out what, I don't know what it is yet. But in dealing with them, that's how I best get along with them. I use a shock value though. I know that there's a lag in the North and South, and I use that to my benefit when I'm dealing with them.
Is the difference that the quid pro quos up North are always unspoken, but down here it's, you know, here's the deal.
Right. That's a part of it right now, but that's one part of it. And the second part of it is the lag that's between the two is also part of the problem. Like I say right now, I can go up to a sheriff now in one of these counties, and I can say, now 10 years ago he probably would have killed me and had me hung, okay? I said, no, you the biggest goddamn sloppy redneck in this goddamn hills. Get your hand off that nigga. He just sit there and look at me and won't say very much. You know, probably go tell him to turn him loose. Because he hasn't quite, in his own mind yet, he hasn't quite understood yet how he's to deal with that and react with the lag yet. You understand what I'm saying? He's trying to, now maybe in another 5 or 10 years he'll understand how he's to react. Right now, because of the desegregation shock and the lag between North and South, they haven't quite developed a proper attitude, a mood just to deal with those kind of issues yet. And I always take advantage of the gaps. Whenever I find gaps in anything, I always try to fill it as soon as I can. If I can't get that personally, I'll fill it verbally or psychologically or something. And keep him on the defensive. And that's when, like in this case, what I'm dealing with legislation, I'm dealing with people in confrontation situations. And I just try to take advantage of them. But as far as being able to, yes, getting in the posture of Nixon's administration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's because he's chosen some very good people. I'm not talking about myself. Most of the guys I've been with are pretty good guys, pretty honest guys. I guess like tends to choose like, so he tends to choose those individuals who feel very much like him. And just like Nixon, see, all Nixon's bad, so to me that's all Nixon's bad too. Is that what you were talking about earlier?
Mm-hmm.
So I think like tends to choose like. If Reuben is bad, then all of his staff's going to be bad. I think if one person goes bad on Reuben's staff, there's a pretty good chance that Reuben is also bad. But if Reuben is pretty strong, and he hangs in there, you know, as a staff of a rod of worth and personal dignity and pride and religious conviction and faith, strong, clean, honest government, I think it's pretty much his staff's going to follow suit.
Do you ever think you'd say that about any guy 3 years ago?
No. Particularly as a northern black, say that about a southern white.
Yeah.
Question. No way. Is Florida a southern state?
I see a way one more. I wonder why I'm still saying that, buddy. But I do.
Are you amazed that you keep on saying it?
Yeah, I am.
Is Florida a southern state?
Yeah. As I said, parts of it. Particularly the upper part. And the only part that's really not southern is really the Miami area, down that area. That's sort of the northern.
But the statewide politics, do you think Florida is a southern state?
Yes. As long, yeah, because see, what I'm saying to you is that the northern part of it is on that little section down on the tip. The rest of Florida is very much like the population. It's in flux because, and as I said, it was in flux socially and attitudinally a few minutes ago. It's also in flux population-wise, up until recently, Florida was basically an uninhabited state. The population here has doubled in the last 10 years. We're picking up about 6,000 people a day into this state. Tallahassee is the fastest growing city in Florida, and it's the second fastest growing city in the United States. So I'm not sure how much longer it will be a southern state at that massive rate of migration into the state. People are pouring in here from all over the country. But right now it is a southern state. And I would say to a large degree, something.
Were you reluctant to come back south? I mean, you had left North Carolina, going to Detroit. Why'd you come back south?
Because he called me 2 or 3 times and asked me to come back.
Who called you?
His staff member, Bill Malloy, for him.
You need to come back to teach him the state?
No, to come back and work for him on his staff.
I mean, but why did you come back to the south at all to teach?
Because I wanted to experience, because I've always grown up in an integrated setting. I've always lived around, you know, blacks and whites. As my own family, I've always gone to black and white schools.
In Winston-Salem?
Well, in Winston-Salem, we went to black schools there, but by factors of segregation, we still all lived together. That's one of the well-kept secrets of blacks. I shouldn't tell you that, though. So we have various forms of intra-racial discrimination, too, among us. And blacks tend to run the color spectrum from chalk to charcoal. And we have a tremendous number of blacks in this country. And last estimates, I read something like about 35,000 blacks in this country every year pass for white, just don't come back, period. I grew up in the South. See, most of my relatives half of them were white. And the people thought they were white, so they worked downtown in various stores and shops and down at the Greyhound bus station and stuff. As whites, they really weren't white, but we all still lived together. Because in the South, it never was a problem. See, the South never discriminated against you as far as home conditions were concerned. They only discriminated against you socially, economically, and educationally. See, whites in the South never cared where you live. I can take care right now. See, whites and blacks will live together. They live together out here in the farm, one farm down the road, and there's a farm together. Or they even let you live in the house. You move in as a maid, live upstairs, or have a bedroom in the back, or you build a place for your folder garage. Southern whites don't care about where you live. But see, it's just the opposite in the North. See, it's only in the North that whites care about where you live, but they don't care about where you go to school and where you work and where you in this other business, where you're employed. See, they're just reversed.
Because you have neighborhood schools, so. If you live in a neighborhood.
Up there?
Yeah.
Well, see, when I went there, see, I still went to a mixed school, like Northwestern High School in Detroit. That school was still mixed. And I went to Wayne with whites and blacks, you know. I worked with whites and blacks. See, it gets to be like a ball game. The whites in the South let you cut up to home plate, but you never get the first, second, or third. In the North, see, you can get on first, second, or third, but you can't never come home because they have residential segregation patterns. You can't ever get to the suburbs. That's why the black in the North is much more frustrated than the black in the South. You know what it's like to get up and knock a ball and get a triple and go all the way to third, and every time you get to third, the game ends? So you get a much more volatile personality, a frustrated, emotionally blocked personality in the black Northern black than you get in the Southern black. That's why I was saying earlier that the blacks in the South are about 100 years in history, because most of them have never been that frustrated about issues like that. They never got concerned about getting or enjoying those things. They don't know what the hell they miss. They've always had home. You hear a black talking about going home, that's what he's talking about. I'm going back South. See, home to them symbolized never having been permitted to go to first, second, third. You go into those large black ghettos in the North now, you hear blacks talking about that, saying, one day I'm going back home. But you mean, I run all these damn bases in the North. I've come to this illusionary nirvana, black paradise, the North, and I can't even get past third base. I can never score a point. And so that's the, and so the South will change, and I guess if you get enough people down here, but right now they're still pretty well in flux between those two, deciding whether they're going to let blacks move home. So as a matter of fact, you get about 100,000 in a city in a given area, you're going to get those residential patterns forming, like you're in Tallahassee now. We begin to get home patterns forming, little suburbs begin to pick up now. So we're going to see segregation here just like it's in the North once you get so many enough people in there. But I take you up in the rural areas, seeing blacks and whites live together. But in Miami, they won't. Because once that part looks like the magic number is about 100,000, you get about 100,000, you get migration and succession patterns begin to form, and they begin to start discriminating against each other home-wise.
Do you have any contacts with Spanish-speaking Floridians?
Yeah, one of my best friends on the Dade County Board of Education, which we put on there, Alfredo Durant. He's sort of a leader of the black, of the Cuban community. And plus one of our my friends on our staff is Charlie Intriago, who's another friend.
Do you see them becoming more of a political force in Florida politics?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you see them staying predominantly in the Republican Party, or is that
no.
Are they now predominantly in the Republican Party?
No, there's been a massive switch over going back to Democrats for several reasons. One reason, they've been pretty well disenchanted with Watergate, and secondly, particularly in view of the fact that Nixon administration gaffed to him and let the Cubans take the blame for the Watergate and some of the break-ins and stuff. So they're disenchanted with the Republicans right now for those two reasons. And thirdly, because we're getting some pretty strong Democratic Cuban leadership in the state, such as Alfredo and some others, who are encouraging them to come over to the Democratic Party.
Is political awareness, per se, growing substantially within that community?
Yes, it is. Very much so. Extremely so. They're very...
Are they more and more thinking of themselves as citizens rather than transients?
At this point, I think they are now.
Rather than sitting in a holding pattern waiting to go back.
At this point, they've just about become firmly convinced that America's going to have to be their home now. So they actively get involved in politics, and matter of fact, they capitalize on the entry advantages they had down there, and they're one of the dominating populations now. See, they've snookered blacks all the way back to the back already. See, blacks down there were gerrymandered between Liberty and Miami, which means their vote is split. See, those in Liberty are not even included in that county population. So the Cuban now, the dominant population in that sense, minority. They out-register them and out-vote them.
Are they likely to be competitive or form coalitions?
I would say it'd be much more of a competitive situation than a coalition. Cubans, like most minority groups, are only concerned about their own minority groups. Blacks are about the only minority group that express concern about all minority groups. I'm on a national task force, but I wasn't there. I think we've just about terminated now, the last 2 years or so, for minority groups. Not any minority group expressing any concern about any other minority group. When I'm with my Chicano friends or Oriones or Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and all the rest of them, Indians. As a matter of fact, we have an Indian commission here, which I also function with. they only talk about their people. They don't even use the word minority groups. The only group that talks about coalitions and collectivism are blacks. They use those terms. They always talk about, we're going to do this for minority groups. The other concern is that we talk about Indians and Puerto Ricans and the Chicano movement. And blacks have never gotten that mature enough to understand the difference even in that.
How about coalitions on statewide politics?
Statewide politics, they would. There would probably be a coalition between the blacks and the Cuban Democrats and the liberal whites in the state. Just don't vote on most of the voting issues. But that's not all of them now. We also have some very ultra-conservative Cubans, too.
How about the economic situation of Cubans?
It was bad, but it's improving rapidly for a lot of different reasons. One reason is the fact they're getting a lot of assistance. Washington gives them, at least it was giving them, $13 million straight out for for their schools. They were getting some pretty good scholarship advantages and into the university system. Also, a lot of the institutions been bending over backwards. They helped them get small business loans and they get started their businesses. And now the greater part of Miami right now is basically owned by the Cubans, by the Cuban community. So they're off and running. And plus we just got a recent state Supreme Court ruling that said they would give Cubans added advantage in getting into law schools, set up a quota for Cubans in law school. And the same thing, I think they're trying to do the same.
Have the state Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah.
End interview with Dr. Claude Anderson. No more transcription. This tape.
A book on the making of the black athlete. It's due with Harper and Row in 2 weeks. And I'm way down the road, man. I'm not anywhere near it. Instead of nightly dark shadows in my eyes. Oh my God, I don't know what I'm gonna do with that thing. I don't know if I'm gonna make it though.
Two weeks isn't very long.
It's not. It really isn't.
Not a report deadline.
And I'm not even sure we don't have my damn charts are anymore. That's got it all out in different piles. And here's some. That was some of the stuff right there. That was one of the little sections I had in one of the chapters. And,